Testing. Can you hear me, Ben?
I mean, I can hear you. Can you hear me is the more important question.
I can, actually. These are pretty fun. I like these headphones.
These are great.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that you wore last time we did a Westerns by the Decade episode.
Are they?
Mm-hmm.
Where's yours?
I had earbuds last time, I think. Oh. But I left them in the car.
Well, I need to get you a pair of headphones for Christmas.
Those are my headphones.
I need to get myself a pair of headphones for Christmas.
The Popstorian Podcast with Chris and Ben.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange in March.
A date which will live in infamy.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Might have gotten away with it, too. If it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The evil of the thriller.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
Great power comes great responsibility.
1950s episode.
This is our 1950s episode.
This is a very important episode.
For a number of reasons. One, this is about the halfway point of our Westerns by the Decade.
Yes.
We should probably talk about, after we record here, off the air, we should talk about our end game and whatever, ending the series.
Yes. Coming faster than we realize.
It is.
So there was a little bit of controversy. I talked to... Oh, I guess we haven't even done our introductions yet, have we?
Introduction. This is Chris.
This is Ben.
Hey, Ben.
We sound different. We have different voices, which is convenient since we're doing a podcast. If we had the same voice,
that would be bad.
You wouldn't be able to tell us apart, but hopefully you can.
Mine is the kind of stuffy... sounding voice at this point. Please forgive the...
Mine is the voice cold. Backed by the rumbling of a hungry stomach.
We are apparently just a mess. We are a mess.
Chris is our resident historian, expert on a lot of historical matters.
Thank you. Don't talk me up too much.
I am the resident film buff /...
filmmaker,
/ filmmaker, I guess you could say.
Put that on your resume there.
General creative person.
I feel like we'll need that a lot today.
This is our main feature of the Popstorian podcast, where we talk about Westerns. We've been picking a different Western for each decade. We intend for this to be a participatory thing, so if you have thoughts, questions, comments, or anything like that, reach out to us.
We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
All the places. You can subscribe to us wherever good podcasts are found. So be sure to do that if you enjoyed today's episode or if you've enjoyed any of our episodes previously. So today, we're talking about...
Rio Bravo.
Rio Bravo.
Westerns by the Decade.
So, now this was somewhat controversial.
Okay.
Because, well, of course we had a hard time picking.
Yeah.
But also, when I was talking to a friend of mine, who's also a Westerns buff,
he said, why didn't you do another Western?
We have an upcoming episode on the 1950s, and he said, what film did you pick from the 1950s to represent the whole of the decade? Was it The Searchers?
And you answered?
No, it's Rio Bravo.
And what was his reaction? I'm curious.
He was a bit disappointed.
Well, alright. So, there was a reason why we chose Rio Bravo.
Yes, there's a couple of reasons.
One reason was that we wanted to represent both John Ford and Howard Hawks, which we could have done in the 40s and 50s with Red River and the Searchers, and I feel like Western buffs would have been more proud of that choice, since Red River and Searchers are considered John Wayne's better films. Mm-hmm. But the drawback to that is that we would have to do back-to-back John Wayne films, and we did want to represent other actors and artists in those decades.
Right.
So, what are you going
to
do?
Also, we had to talk about Howard Hawks.
We do, so. Yeah. Now, the 50s were very hard, because I think we established in one of our minisodes that the 50s are the best mm-hmm. decade for Westerns.
We both agreed on that.
We did both agree on
and,
that.
In fact, the Popstorian community voted.
Yes.
And agreed on
and
that.
And agreed on that. Because you have High Noon, you've got Shane, you have mm-hmm. the Searchers, of course Rio Bravo. Mm-hmm. There's a great many Westerns in the 1950s that really stand out. So, this was a hard choice.
This was a very hard choice.
And obviously controversial with you and your friends.
I will freely admit that I picked Rio Bravo because it's one that I've not seen.
That's fair.
I voted for Rio Bravo because I wanted to experience it and have some more in-depth knowledge of it. Which I don't have because I didn't do as much research as I was planning.
I voted Rio Bravo because this is one of my favorite John Wayne movies ever. True story. But I've learned to love it even more now that I've actually done some research on it. So this is going to be a fun episode.
Well, this is going to be fun. So shall we start with our usual rambling synopsis?
Well, we've already rambled, so maybe we should...
we'll just do a synopsis. We'll
just do a synopsis now. Would you like to do a synopsis, Ben?
Yeah, I will attempt a good synopsis. So okay. We're in the town of Rio Bravo down in Texas, and the film basically opens with a silent or dialogue-less sequence where one of the brothers of a prominent town boss or a successful rancher who basically runs this town of Rio Bravo.
Right.
One of his brothers, is that correct?
It's his younger brother.
His younger brother is kind of stirring up trouble around the town, making fun of the town drunk, and just in general, making a mess of the place.
Yeah.
The sheriff, played by, of course, John Wayne, intervenes, is promptly rewarded by a swift blow to the head.
By the town drunk, who is also...
By the town drunk, played by...
Is Dean Martin.
Dean Martin, who also, I didn't even recognize at first.
It also happens to be his deputy... Right. The town.
Who was also, well, I think a former deputy at this point in the story, right?
It's ambiguous, because I don't know if he's wearing a star when he comes in. I forget if he was.
I don't think he's wearing a star at the beginning, but I could be wrong.
But there is definitely the backstory that he was the deputy, and then he came back to town, and he continues those duties as the story progresses in the film. And there's no part where he's like, you're now my deputy, you're not my deputy, or anything like that. So it's kind of ambiguous.
I always forget to say this, but you should... fair listener, you should definitely watch the movie before you listen to this podcast, because we may spoil some things throughout.
It's true. Spoiler alert.
Now I've said that, I'll attempt to continue. So, in the process of stirring up trouble, his name is Burnett. Excuse me, Burdett. Joe Burdett. Is it Joe Burdett or Nathan Burdett?
Joe is the troublemaker. Nathan is the boss.
So Joe Burdett kills a man in the process of stirring up trouble and making fun of the town drunk and fighting with the marshal. The man gets killed.
Murdered, actually.
Murdered.
Yeah. This is played by Claude Atkins, if mm-hmm. I recall correctly.
Yep, correct.
And he is arrested by Sheriff.
By the sheriff, and the deputy helps the town drunk, Dean Martin. Dude. Borachon is his nickname, which just means drunk.
According to the movie, I actually didn't look up what that term really means in Spanish.
Yeah,
did you actually look it up?
Okay. Yes. So they apprehend him, and they take him to the town jail. Now, the interesting thing about the town jail, this is kind of the most interesting part of the movie, in a way, is the way that this is structured story-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So the town jail is kind of in the center of town, and he has a guard there, played by Walter Brennan, named Stumpy. And Stumpy kind of lives in the jail. The jail is made out of stone, so it's very solid. There's only one door in or out. And it's you can't really get a drop on it without storming it. So it's sort of situated like a fortress.
Right.
And Joe Burdett, being part of a prominent family, has many people hired by his brother to come and rescue him. But they can't just openly storm the jail because it's a fortress and they wouldn't succeed.
Plus there's this little threat made by Stumpy that he would blow Joe's head off with a shotgun if they tried it. So Nathan, being a good brother, doesn't want that to happen to his brother. So there's a standoff, which is most of the film.
Yeah, that's sort of the crux of the whole story arc, is that he's in jail. His brother wants to get him out, but John Wayne... What's John Wayne's character's name again?
John T. Chance.
John T. Chance. Sheriff John T. Chance and his boys are keeping him tightly under wraps until a marshal comes to town.
Right.
Which is in 6 days, I think, at the beginning of the movie.
I believe you're right. Something in the way.
We find all this out, all this exposition, via Ward Bond's character, a passing wagon train leader named Pat Wheeler. And Wheeler is kind of an old friend of Sheriff Chance.
Yeah.
And they kind of converse about Chance's dilemma. And that gives the audience all that information that we just gave you. Also, so it's done pretty effectively. It doesn't feel too
And this is also introduces one of the main themes of the film as well. Because Wheeler offers his help as well as the help of his wagon drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And Chance refuses it in grounds that they're all amateurs, that they'd be worried about their families versus trying to protect the sheriff and the jail. And this is one of the main themes in the film. As you go on through the film, you'll notice that he turns down a lot of help in this movie.
Yeah, this also is a good opportunity to introduce another supporting character who's riding along with Wheeler, Wheeler's wagon train. He's a gunslinger?
Yeah, a young gun.
For hire. His father was apparently something of a legend. His name is Colorado. And this young guy is played by Ricky Nelson.
Yes, indeed.
Another pop star of the era.
Very popular. I think I'm introduction. I find it very interesting in this movie that everybody's got a nickname, except for Pat Wheeler and like the Burdettes,
right?
Because you got like Chance goes by his last name Chance, and then you got Dude and Colorado,
yeah.
And then I'm sure you're going to introduce the next character, Feathers.
Yes, Feathers. So in looking through my extensive records of what movies I have and haven't watched, I discovered this is my first, the first film I've seen with Angie Dickinson in it.
Really?
I believe.
You know?
If I'm remembering that correctly.
I can't remember.
I've seen some of her TV shows.
I can't remember if I've seen any other Angie Dickinson either. I don't know the name.
Right. This is kind of her, an early role for her.
It is. It's one of her breakout roles.
She comes in on her character comes in on the stage, and her name is Feathers, and she's sort of, she's a gambler. She ran with a gambler. She's good at cards.
Yeah.
And the sheriff kind of catches wind that she's up to something, tells her she has to leave town on the stage the next day. But she sort of falls in love with him and decides to hang around.
She's actually not up to anything, though. There's a key, key statement there. Is that he accuses her, and she's like, no, I'm not guilty.
Uh-huh. Well, before she does that, she kind of offers to let him strip search her, and he becomes very sort of like flustered and embarrassed.
Which is I think the whole relationship between them throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
So
it's a little bit strange to me because Angie Dickinson around this time looks about like 20.
She is. She's very young in this film.
She's very young, and John Wayne is not so young.
It's actually funny. I was reading about Angie Dickinson's, an interview with her and her remembrances of this film. Is that she recalls that she liked John Wayne's movies when she was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
there was that distinctive.
Right.
But she said they had great chemistry, and that she suspects that if she wasn't involved with someone and he hadn't been married at the time, something may have happened. But as far as either one of them said, nothing happened. Just want to put that out there.
That's a little aside.
But apparently they got along just fine.
Yeah.
Almost that.
So one of the other hubs of action of the story where this all takes place, the card games and whatnot, is the hotel, which is run by our token Hispanic character.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair statement in the 1950s.
Carlos,
who actually has done a number of films in this genre.
Mm-hmm. Pedro Gonzalez.
Yes,
is his name, the actor's name.
Forgetting his name, but he has done several character parts like this mm-hmm. before.
It's very enjoyable. He has a wife who sort of henpecks him a bit.
Yeah.
Gives him a hard time. I'm not sure that the actress is actually Hispanic.
I'm not sure.
Or if she's just in makeup.
Yeah, it could go either way. The 1950s, after all.
But he kind of plays a key role in the story, giving information to Chance throughout and kind of...
Yeah, he does kind of play that. He plays a friend that's... another friend that offers help.
Mm-hmm.
And is often turned away, or at least kind of scooted over the side, and he's allowed to give messages, but not anything else.
Yeah. So where do things start to escalate here?
Pat Wheeler.
Wheeler gets killed.
Yeah, he comes in, offers his help, and he starts talking around town that the sheriff needs help, and he walks out in the middle of the street and is shot. Gunned down.
Alas for Ward Bond.
He's not in the film very much.
No. And I think this is towards the end of his career.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
I think he passes away soon after, early 60s.
Which is kind of sad, because we were just talking about him and how we want to see him in more stuff when we were talking about My Darling Clementine.
Yeah. Him and Walter Brennan are the two actors that are in both our 1940s and 1950s picks,
mm-hmm.
even though there are, 14 years, 13 years apart.
Yeah, pretty solid distance.
Yeah. Both are great actors.
Mm-hmm.
But he's killed, his character's killed in this scene, and the sheriff and dude run after the killer. Colorado at this point they've offered him a spot on the team. Say, Colorado, you're a professional, you can come help us. And he's like, no, I think I'll stay out of this. None of my business.
Mm-hmm.
And then after his boss is
which is
killed,
kind of presented as a virtue, almost, that he minds his own business.
Sheriff Chance is like, he's a smart kid. Wish I could have him, but it's all right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a paraphrase of his line. And then when Wheeler is killed, Colorado comes back and it says, I want in now because they kill my boss.
Right.
And of course John Wayne pushes him away and says, I wouldn't have let my boss get killed in the first place.
Right.
We don't want you now. And that kind of ends their relationship just for the first act.
Yeah.
He's back introduced again later on. But they chase down the killer.
They track him into the saloon where a dude notices some blood dripping into a glass of beer. That's how he notices that it's revealed to him that the killer is
hiding in the rafters
overhead.
Now, this is an important part because...
It is.
Dude has been thought of at this point by the bad guys as the drunk, as the town drunk. Mm-hmm. And he comes in the front door after some debate with John Wayne's character. And they kind of laugh at him. They weren't expecting him to do anything great. But then he kills the assassin with one shot,
mm-hmm.
which surprises everybody.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes him much more of a target.
Yeah, he was the backstory that's kind of revealed in pieces as we go along is that dude was a successful deputy, a great shot, until some woman came in on the stage. He fell in love with her, even though the sheriff said she was no good. He rode off with her. She broke his heart or robbed him or some sort of thing. Sort of split happened.
And he comes back.
And he comes back and sort of falls into drinking, becomes an alcoholic, and is now pretty much all his legacy is ignored by the villains until he kills this kills this assassin in the saloon.
I mean, that's a fair assessment of his backstory.
Yeah, I think that's the condensed version. This is a long movie.
It is a very long movie. It's 141 minutes, which
so we'll keep moving.
Quite a long film for what you get here.
So Chance doesn't sleep in the jail, where Walter Brennan shouts out who goes there in hilarious ways.
He's a grouchy old man again.
He plays an excellent grouchy old man, much different from his character, his sort of vicious, world-wise character in My Darling Clementine.
Yeah.
He's more of a...
Tongue-in-cheek,
sardonic...
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair.
Yeah. So Chance goes back to the hotel, has some more interactions with Feathers. They talk for a while. She ends up standing guard at his door all night to let him sleep.
Another instance where she's offering help and he is...
He's kind of refusing.
Refusing, pushing her away.
I know, you... Throughout the whole film we were watching, you were like, I don't get Feathers' character.
In some of the readings I've been doing, that they compare her a lot with Lauren Bacall's character in the Have to Have Not, which was another Howard Hawks film,
right?
And including their dialogue being very similar to each other.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know if you want to call her a token female character in Howard Hawks film. I was reading someone else and they're saying Howard Hawks like to make his female characters as strong as the male leads, so that there's some that push back that tension.
It's a very famous Hawksian approach.
Yeah, very much so. So, I don't know if you really can consider this film a Hawks movie if it didn't have a strong female lead, even though it just seems like her characters just frill and fringe. But a lot of this movie kind of seems that way, because you have the basic premise of them pulling off the bad guys, and then there's a shootout at the end. And then the rest of the film is filled out with this backstory of Dude and his struggle with alcoholism, Chance finding love with Feathers, Stumpy trying to not blow somebody's head off in the back room, Colorado coming of age in this film. So there's a lot of little characters floating around, but it kind of, I think we talked about this again, My Darling Clementine, about how you have a beginning and you have an end, but how does all the pieces make it to the end?
Yeah.
And I think this is another example of that. Maybe not as tight-knit as Ford would be.
Yeah, definitely not as tightly knit as the last film we watched.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at this point, it kind of... There's kind of a various threads happening. There's the introduction of a song called the Cutthroat Song.
Yeah. And this is where we introduce Colorado again.
Right, Colorado comes back. The brother starts to appear more in the story. He gets the band in the saloon to play the Cutthroat Song.
Right.
Which is kind of the song that they played outside the Alamo to
Nathan
strike terror into the hearts of the imprisoned people.
Yeah. So that's the backstory on that. Nathan comes into town to see his brother, and he goes into the jail, which cut a lot of exposition there too. And the kind of idea of like, well...
Some backstory for Walter Brennan's character.
Yeah.
Slipped in there very gingerly.
Walter Brennan's such a great character.
He was my favorite part of this movie, I'll be honest.
I mean, that's fair right there. He's a great part of the film. And then Nathan gets angry, realizes that there's no way he's going to get into his brother without his brother getting killed. So he kind of sets up this Cutthroat Song in his saloon, kind of realizing, kind of showing them siege warfare here. And Colorado hears that he's in the saloon when he gives the order to play that song. And he comes back over to Chance and tells him what it is and what it means. And so Chance is like, well, I guess we got him to talk after all. So now you have it completely set up. You got the bad guys waiting around, kind of the siege stance, and then you have the tension between Chance and his deputies building. And I do confess that this film could have done that a little bit better, a little more suspenseful.
There's a few There's a few suspense building scenes where you think that something's about to happen, and then it's a false
kind of a false start.
So yeah. There's a scene where I can't remember exactly where in the film all these take place, but Dean Martin's character is coming back to the jail with some supplies or from patrolling the town,
mm-hmm.
and Walter Brennan's character Stumpy shoots at him because
he doesn't recognize
dude forgets
him.
Dude forgets to holler and say that he's there and that it's him and that it's safe for him to come in, so he just starts blasting, not knowing who's coming in the door.
So
that, of course, John Wayne's in the hotel and he comes running over, and
they kind of show you how tensions are high.
Yeah, that's like the first step of the tensions rising.
Right.
Then there's another sequence where Burdett's men, when they come into the town, do kind of patrols the outskirts and makes them leave their guns at the entrance and that sort of thing. At one point, they get the, around this point in the story that we're at, I think, they get the drop on him.
Yeah.
Tie him up, put on his clothes, start to approach the jail to try and get the drop on the Duke.
Right.
Skipping over anything?
No, I'm hearing some background noise from downstairs. but anyway, you get the drop on John Wayne's character. He was talking to Colorado, who went in to get some cigarettes or matches for a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And they stop John Wayne when he's inside. And Colorado notices what's going on, tells Feathers to throw a flower pot through the, which is one of the kind of key moments of the film. People always remember the flower pot. And Colorado comes out and helps John Wayne's character out, shooting two of the three, and then John Wayne gets the third one plus the guy who was patrolling the outside of the town.
Yeah, pretending
so
to be
two,
dude.
Two for two. For either one. And then they, of course, welcome Colorado in as
on the team
as a deputy at that point.
Mm-hmm. They decide they have some music. There's a few musical numbers.
So this film, I have to talk about the music because the music is very important to this film.
Should we wrap up the synopsis and then circle back?
Yeah, let's do that because I do want to talk about a little bit more about this.
I want to go into detail on a lot of these things
that
we're covering, but I kind of want to get through the synopsis and then go back. So they have some music. They decide, we're just going to hunker down, get a lot of supplies, stay in the jail, and wait for the marshal to get here to take away our prisoner. As they're doing this, Burdett launches his sort of final assault.
Right.
His final plan. So they go to the hotel to kind of get a bath, get some supplies, and whatnot. But Burdett's men have already kind of taken over the hotel. They've captured Carlos and his lady. They tie a tripwire across the stairs, then cause the lady to holler. That's my word today. Holler.
It's a good word. Good word.
She yells. The Duke comes running down the stairs, trips over the tripwire, is captured. But at this point, the bad guys don't know because all their associates were killed and nobody's left alive to tell them that Colorado's on their side and that Colorado's in the jail. So they head for the jail to release Joe because they've captured the sheriff and dude.
Yeah.
But only to be basically blown away by Colorado
and
Stumpy.
Yeah. So that sets us up for the final act of the film. Is that dude's been captured. They still have Joe. But now they're selling a... If they don't trade Joe for Dude, they're going to just kill Dude.
Right.
And of course it's discussed that, well, they're going to kill Dude and Chance anyway after they get Joe, because they're the only witnesses to the murder. Enter the final fight scene.
Yes.
So they decide to take Joe out, and Colorado volunteers to join Chance, and they tell Stumpy he has to stay in the jail because he's an old cripple and can't move around too fast, which of course breaks the old man's heart. It's really kind of a sad thing. Walter Brennan, again, praises for his acting abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But they march him into this old barn, and then they have the famous, you send your prisoner out, we'll send our prisoner out standoff.
Mm-hmm. And they're in a barn. The Burdett men are
in a warehouse.
Sort of in a house, yeah.
Yeah. And they so they're marching. Joe Burdett marching out. Dude comes out. And right then, Dude decides to tackle Joe. And so he tackles Joe off to one side, and they hide behind a little broken down house. And of course, the shooting starts between the sheriff and the bad guys.
Yeah.
And Dude and Joe are fighting with fists. And Dude finally takes him down, and more shooting happens, and then finally the bad guys decide we're going to break out and get around him, and they almost do, because they realize we can't get over there, and then suddenly a shotgun rings out, and both the bad guys are gone.
And who is it?
Our old friend, Stumpy.
Yes, Stumpy saves the day.
He really is the greatest.
Now, the interesting part about this is that he takes cover behind a wagon,
which happens to be full of dynamite, which we learned actually in the beginning of the film when Wheeler brings his wagon train through the town.
Ah.
Yeah.
Forgot about that part.
So he's hiding behind the dynamite, and Colorado remembers and says, you better tell Stumpy to move, because that wagon's full of dynamite. And so Chance is running around trying to get to Stumpy, and he says, get out of there, Stumpy. And Stumpy's like, it's a good... I love Walter Brennan. It's like, I got a good seat. It's a good...
It's a great spot.
And John Wayne's like, it's a good spot, all right. That's full of dynamite. And so...
This leads us to John Wayne and Walter Brennan lobbing dynamite at the warehouse where the villains are holed up. And John Wayne literally... Or I think Dude. Isn't it Dude who's doing the shooting?
So both John Wayne and Dude start... So John Wayne starts shooting, and there's some repertoire... what is the French word? Repertoire between Walter Brennan and John Wayne. And they're like, get out there. And Stumpy's like, never can satisfy you. It's the grumpy old man.
There's some great dialogue in this film.
And they...
I have to say.
They blow up a couple, and then Dude says, throw one for me.
Mm-hmm.
And Dude takes two shots instead of one, because he's not as good as John Wayne. And so they blow up the warehouse, and finally Joe Burdett... Nathan Burdett and his band give up, and they come out with their hands up and everything. And that ends the tension, and the siege is broken.
And but then, the movie's not over yet.
It's not.
There's a little coda.
There's another, it's at least 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
Where we kind of finish up with the sheriff and Feathers, and Sheriff John T. Chance tells her that he loves her, but not really.
But not really.
She
confesses to being in love with him. She sort of, like, threatens... She's already kind of, like, coerced her way into staying in town. Because he wanted her to leave in the beginning.
Right.
But she got a job at the hotel. Tending bar, basically.
Basically.
Now she's threatening to be a dancing girl.
Yeah.
And apparently she was that at some point in the past, because she has a costume.
To match. And for some reason this bothers Chance... Presumably because he loves her. And there's some really witty, fast dialogue between the two characters. And the scene ends with her throwing, or him throwing her tights out the window, which is quite the innuendo. And of course, Stumpy and Dude are walking underneath.
She wasn't wearing the tights when...
Well, right.
She was holding them.
And he grabbed them.
And he grabbed them from her. Just wanted to clarify that.
That's true.
But yes, the innuendo remains.
The innuendo is still there. And so Stumpy picks up the tights. And he wraps around his neck. He's like, you think I ever be sheriff? And Dude says, not unless you mind your own business. Which ends it to the theme song, Rio Bravo, sung by Dean Martin. And that's how they finish the film out.
Yes, indeed. There we go. That might be our... most concise synopsis we've ever done. And it's with a film that's kind of difficult to synopsize.
To nail down, yeah.
Because it's...
And it's long. It's a very long film.
It's long, and it's sort of rambly in parts.
So this film, to kind of put this in perspective with the rest of the films that we've done, is actually probably the longest film that we've done. Maybe.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
The Covered Wagon, maybe it's match.
I feel like my Darling Clementine is... pretty long as well, but not quite as long.
I don't know if I have to look back on that. But it's a pretty long film. It's also our first film in color. completely in color.
That's true.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that.
The color is coming into films now.
Uh-huh. This is the late 50s, 1959.
1959 was released. So color has been well established since, of course, you know, 39 with The Wizard of Oz, but it's not regularly used, and this is our first film that it really kind of comes into the Western here. Not the first color Western, I might add, but
yeah, color Western.
Yeah. So the music is one of the things I really want to talk about.
Yeah, please.
So this film stars Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not familiar with these two individuals, then you probably don't listen to a lot of 1950s music. Dean Martin, of course, is a famous crooner. He's part of the Rat Pack. I think they wanted Frank Sinatra to play the part originally, but Dean Martin got the part here.
I guess Frank Sinatra would be known already as a successful actor.
He's
pretty
well
established.
Yeah, from the 40s, he was well established in the 1940s.
Yeah.
Dean Martin crossover. Had done a few films. He'll become probably more famous in the 1960s for mm-hmm. his films. Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were quite famous as a comedy team now.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Ricky Nelson was coming on the scene as a teen idol pop
yeah.
star. Kind of character.
So he's sort of the young up-and-comer.
Right. So, of course, you have to have these guys sing.
Right.
Although this is the first film Dean Martin does with John Wayne, he'll actually do two.
Mm-hmm.
The other is Sons of Kitty Elder, where he doesn't sing on camera for that film. But he does sing a song in this film called Me, My Gun, and My Pony. Or My Gun, My Pony, and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And which is kind of like a crooning country western song,
becomes a classic
with a full soundtrack behind it too, I might add. Not just Stumpy playing his mouth harp.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ricky Nelson will double down on this musical episode with singing Get Along Little Susie, which is also kind of a country western
yeah
type of song, and become one of his staples. Mm-hmm. I think in his career. Which Walter Brennan does sing in this film, too.
He does. To my enraptured delight.
Yes. unfortunately, John Wayne does not join in the chorus. Which is, I think, it would have added so much to this film if he had. but anyway, so you gotta have these guys. They're very, very big names for the time. But then I also want to talk about Dmitri Tiomkin. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Mm-hmm.
Great deal. But he is really one of the great film composers.
Yeah.
Not just of the day, but he's in the top 10 for like the whole decade, a whole century. Really.
Yeah.
He's been nominated 22 times for Academy Awards, won 4, which is actually an amazing ratio.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about John Williams, who's been nominated for over 50 times,
mm-hmm.
has won, I think, 5 or 6.
Gotcha.
So
percentage-wise,
he's actually really high up there.
Dmitri's even higher.
I mean, you really want to think about it. I think John Barry has a better ratio between than both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really one of the great, great,
great
composers
yeah.
of American film. And I just was reading about him today. I really want to read more.
It seems like a fascinating person.
He is. And what's interesting to me about him is he actually did the music and actually, I think, won an Academy Award for High Noon.
Mm-hmm. Which has an excellent score.
Which it does. I mean, it has best original song and mm-hmm. best score. Are you going to sing?
Nope, just whistle.
Oh, okay. and so he did both of these films, which is kind of interesting to me because one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about Rio Bravo is because
yeah.
of the rivalry between it and High Noon. and this plays a part in the 1950s Red Scare. High Noon had come out in 1952, I think, or 51.
Thereabouts, yeah.
And it actually wins, I think it wins Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Or it definitely wins Best Actor for Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a thorn in John Wayne's side, for one thing, because he actually was I don't think even nominated for his work in The Quiet Man, and The Quiet Man was this big, big deal for him at that same time. But he, John Wayne goes on record, I think a few times, saying he doesn't like High Noon because of the way it portrays American institutions. The sheriff kind of goes to the church folk and asks for help, and they just kind of turn him down and kind of become really quite hypocritical, and he felt that this was an affront against the American way.
Yeah.
And John Wayne is very political, particularly in the 1950s.
Very right-wing.
Very much political. So. He wanted to do a film to kind of answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Hawks didn't like High Noon either, but kind of for somewhat different reasons.
Oh.
He felt that he wasn't... Howard Hawks is not really that political of a figure. A lot of his films aren't very political. But he didn't like the film because he felt like the sheriff was kind of a loser. He's kind of a wimp.
Right.
Uh-huh. He goes around the town. I think his words are, he goes around the town like a wet chicken, and it ends up his Quaker wife saving him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the thing he didn't like about it, is that the sheriff doesn't protrude like this manly, heroic image that he thinks should be there. So that is why, in Rio Bravo, the sheriff is the exact opposite.
Right.
Where everybody offers him help, but he refuses it, versus him asking for everybody's help, and they refuse him to come out and help him. So that's kind of the big reversal there.
For more of Ben and Chris's exciting discussion of Rio Bravo, tune in next week to the Popstorian Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Popstorian Podcast. Be sure to subscribe. You can find us online at popstorian.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Tune in next time for more of the history of popular culture.